Samuel chapter 30. We're on a series on David. And you'll notice in your bulletin, it's all listed there. This is part 7. And they kind of build on each other, but each one is self-contained. Now, you've heard of different places that are famous in the Bible, like Jerusalem and Hebron and Philippi and Athens and different places that have a lot of meaning packed to them. Now, today, there's a place I'm going to preach on called the Besor Stream. Just put the title of the message up. And most of us probably never heard of the Besor. It's called the Besor Ravine in this NIV, or the Besor Brook. But basically, a little stream, okay? Not a river, not a lake, but a little stream. It's called the Besor Stream. But something takes place at the Besor Stream that my prayer, my hope this morning is that from now on, the rest of your lives, you'll have in your mind, I'm at the Besor Stream, or she's at the Besor Stream, and understand what it means, okay? Because it really is one of those places that is to be in our hearts, and I think in our vocabulary throughout our Christian lives and living together as a community. So the story begins in chapter 30, and I'm going to have to summarize most of it to you, and I'm going to read the key verses, but I want to encourage you to read it when you go home. In fact, I'd encourage you to read 1 and 2 Samuel as I go through David in your spare time at home as well. But the story in chapter 30 begins in a disaster. If you remember, David was running away from Saul for about 10 to 13, maybe 15 years. And while he was in the desert, certain men gathered around him. And we mentioned a few weeks ago about David's mighty men. 400 initially joined him in the desert, and then 200 more joined. So he had 600 men who, with their families, their wives and children, that for years lived with David as fugitives, running for their lives from Saul the king. And during that time period, they often went on military missions. And at this stage, the 600 of them, the men had gone away on a mission to fight some of their enemies. And while they're away, they left the camp unprotected where the women and children were and all of their wealth. And while they were away, a raiding band of Amalekites, Amalekites were the fierce enemies of Israel, they invaded the camp while the men were gone, and they burned the camp down. They stole all the money, all the wealth, and they took the wives and the children captive as slaves. And they left. So when the 600 men with David came back to the camp was burned to the ground, and their wives and their children were gone. So that's in verses 3 to 7. And so then David and his men begin to grieve and lament. That was last week's sermon. Get that tape if you missed it. Very important message. But their lamenting quickly turned to anger. And the men decided they want to get rid of David because he was a crummy leader. A good leader would never have left the camp unprotected. So they decide they want to kill David and stone him to death. And verse 6, it says that David was greatly distressed. Now, when disaster strikes, basically it either brings out the best in us or the worst in us. Now, I don't know about you. When disaster strikes in your life, what does it bring out in you? For the 600 men, it brought out the worst. They want to kill David and get rid of him. And whatever gains they had made in their holiness and walk with God was out the window. You know, 2 steps forward, 12 steps back. That's what's happening here. These 600 guys, you know, they lose it. Now remember, these 600 men were, it's described in chapter 22, they were in distress, in debt, and discontented. These guys were losers. And David had made these folks into an army. And he taught them to worship, to pray, to spend time with God. And he was molding them into a mighty force. And they were David's friends. But again, when tough times came, these 600 wanted to kill David. So it brought out the worst in them. Now, David, on the other hand, when disaster strikes, it brings out the best in him. Now, look at verse 6. David was greatly distressed. Basically, the word distressed means in Hebrew, in a very tight place. He has nowhere to move. He's very distressed. Because the men were talking of stoning him. You think your friends are bad. Each one was bitter in spirit because of his sons and daughters. But David found strength in the Lord his God. Underline that. Now the situation is everybody's bitter, angry, their army's falling apart. It's a disaster. And in the midst of this chaos and things going so badly, David doesn't blame God. Now, he could have got really mad at God. You know, God, it's bad enough. You anointed me king. I'm running for my life. I've lost my family. I've lost everything. Now, these guys are turning against me. He doesn't get defensive and go to the 600 guys. Listen, you know what? You're in the army now. This is just the way it is. You know, toughen up. You know, he doesn't get angry at them. But David, it brings out the best in David, because what David does is in his distress, in his anguish, the word used here is he strengthens himself in God. He basically, he prays. He worships. He goes inside himself into God. And he gets an inner strength from God. Now, we don't know exactly how he did it, prayer, worship. And then he goes, in verse 7, he calls Abiathar, the priest. And he goes to the priest, and he gets spiritual counsel from a mentor, somebody mature. Most of us, what we would do is we'd find somebody who would help us curse the men. He goes, and his desire to go to God, he goes to godly, mature counsel, who basically then gives him counsel. And he comes out of a place of quietness and reflection with God. He gets strength in God, and then he gets a plan from God. And then in the midst of this disaster, David stands up and says to the 600 men who now hate him, we are going to go find these Amalekites, and we're going to recapture our wives, our children, and all of our wealth. And so David gets these 600 men to follow him, and they go on a march. Now understand, they're exhausted. They've just been in battle. And they're tired. They're fatigued. And David now gets them at least to march forward. And they go about 15 miles until they get to the Besor stream, or it's called here the Besor ravine, or the New American Standard calls it the Besor brook. Verse 9, let's pick it up here. Ready? David and the 600 men with him came to the Besor ravine, where some stayed behind, for 200 men were too exhausted to cross the ravine. But David and 400 men continued the pursuit. So now what happens? Of the 600 men, one-third, 200 says, we quit. At the Besor stream, they say, we're exhausted physically and emotionally, we're shot. We don't know. David, they're in a desert. So they don't want to trust that David knows where he's going, because he's already messed up things once. And they don't have it in them to go forward anymore. They quit. And they say, we'll guard the supplies. We're staying here. And they stay at the Besor ravine, these 200 men. Now, what happens is the story goes on. Now just imagine the scene. Okay, if you're one of the 600, you're one of the 400 that's going to go on. These guys now take off their shoes and start to soak their feet in the ravine. Okay, and cook a little rice and beans on the stove. And basically, they're hanging out now while these 400 are going to risk their lives and go into war. So, the story goes on. You know, God provides an Egyptian slave and bada, bada, bada. And they find the Amalekites and their wives and children. And these 400 go to war with David. And they beat the Amalekites. And they win back their wives and children and bounty. It's a great victory. And now they're going to go back to the camp. And they're going to go back home. But on the way marching home, they're back at the Besor stream where the 200 are waiting there with the supplies. Now, how do you think those 400 feel about the 200? Who basically stayed home and washed their feet in the ravine while they were out there fighting, risking their lives. And so now we pick it up in verse 21. Then David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow him and who were left behind them at the Besor ravine, or I'm calling it the Besor stream. They came out to meet David and the people with him. And as David and his men approached, he greeted them. But all the evil men and troublemakers among David's followers. Now, that's basically most of the 400. And they said, because they did not go out with us, we will not share with them the plunder we recovered. However, each man may take his wife and children and go. Verse 23. This is the climax of the story. So the 400 say, you know what? We're not sharing with these creeps who did not go fight with us. Now David intervenes. Here's the climax. No, my brothers, you must not do that with what the Lord has given us. He has protected us and handed over to us the forces that came against us. Who will listen to what you say? The share of the man who stayed with the supplies is to be the same as that of him who went down to battle. All will share alike. David made this a statute and ordinance for Israel from that day to this. So, now, so much for the mighty men. They come back from battle. They don't want to share with the 200. Now, David makes a ruling. He says, let's get something straight at the stream of Besor. The guys who stayed behind, who quit, who were too exhausted to go on for whatever reason, they get the equal share to those who fought. And he makes it a law, and the basic law is equality. Now, I want to make basically two little points. What David's point is basically this. Listen, guys, you don't understand. And you'll notice in verse 23 and 24, it's God who gave us the victory. Listen, God, you guys, you were picked up from the pit. You were a bunch of losers. You were in debt. You were discontented. You were in despair. God picked you up through me. We made you into an army. You're on your way to becoming mighty men. It's all been the grace of God that you've made it this far. And you know what? God's the one who led us to the Amalekites in the desert. It's God who enabled us to win that battle. And the fact that we're here is a gift from God. It's all grace. And everything is sheer grace. And so David is, how can you think about dividing things up fairly when everything that you've received was a gift? And God, you know, his point is God's treated you with marvelous grace. And now in the same way, you must treat these men with marvelous grace because it's all grace. David remembers what it's like to be left out and left behind as the eighth son of Jesse. And so I want to make really two points. Now, with the overhead up, there's two little points I want to make to you. I want you to write them down, think about them. And the first is this. When you're tempted to judge, again, I know most of you don't judge, but at first service we had a few. When you're tempted to look down at somebody who basically is not performing the way you think they should, someone who's a, quote, weaker brother, someone who's quit, someone who's demoralized, someone who is not living out the faith the way you think they should, someone who doesn't believe everything correctly like you, and you're tempted to basically judge them. And you say, well, you know what? When the blessings come, buddy, you're out. Remember this. When you're tempted to judge, remember God's grace is extravagant. Now, we don't mind if God's grace is extravagant to us. What bothers is the grace is extravagant to everybody else. And his goodness makes us mad. I mean, it doesn't make us mad when his goodness is coming my way, but it does make me mad when he's so good to some of you, especially when you don't deserve it. Because our understanding is we deserve it. And we forget that grace by its very nature is undeserving. And when you start thinking God owes you one, because you've been to battle and you're serving him and giving your time, energy, and money, and you risked your life and I've been good and all this, and you think God owes you one, you're no longer on grace, you're now on performance. And that's what happens very quickly. You start treating other people that way. You know, Martin Luther said it well. God cannot stand it when we boast of anything but his grace. Now, remember the parable of the vineyard in Matthew chapter 20. It really goes with this text. And remember, David points us to Jesus. He's a type of Christ. And remember, in Matthew 20, a landowner goes out. He hires these men to work the vineyard in Matthew 20. And he hires the first workers at 6 o'clock in the morning. And he says, I'm going to pay you one denarii. Let's just call it $80 a day. I'm going to pay you $80. Work till 6 o'clock. You get $80. So they go to work. Then at 9 o'clock, he hires some other guys. And he says, listen, go out to work, and I'll pay you a fair wage at the end of the day at 6 o'clock at night. And then he goes out at 12 o'clock. He hires a bunch of other guys. He says, listen, go out, work. I'll pay you a fair wage when the day is over. At 3 o'clock, he hires some other people. Go out and work. I'll pay you a fair wage at the end of the day. Then at 5 o'clock, 1 hour before closing time, he goes out and hires another group of people and says, listen, go out and work in the vineyard. At the end of the day, I'm going to pay you fairly. The end of the day comes, and the landowner pays the guy who went to work at 5 o'clock first. And what's he give him? $80. And the guys who worked at 3 o'clock, they come forward. He gives them $80. So you can imagine what the guys who went to work at 6 o'clock are thinking. I'm going to make a killing here. 500, at least, maybe 1,000. 9 o'clock, I mean, I know what's going through their minds. And then, Jesus, the other guy comes at 12 o'clock, he gives him $80. Everybody gets $80. And so you can imagine the guys who went to work at 6 o'clock are very angry about this injustice. And Jesus' reply is, don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money or grace? Or are you envious because I am so generous? And David's point is, friends, it is sheer grace. Most of us, we're penny pinchers. We work on performance. The amazing message of Jesus in the gospel, and David grasps it, is that the gospel lifts the least effective, the least fruitful, those who are spiritual latecomers, and don't get a big head that you got it over somebody else. And in fact, it's all grace. And David models compassion because he's received grace. You know, when I'm living in grace, I give grace. When I'm not living in grace, I don't give it. Some of you know that. When I'm standing in the fact that all of my life is a gift, when I'm washing and soaking in the grace of God for me personally, that the fact that I'm here today is by his grace. The fact that I'm alive is by his grace. The fact that I'm walking with him today is a gift. The fact that my heart has got enough desire for him, it's all gift. It's all grace. when I'm living in that sheer grace, it's I can't help but give grace to the person who has stayed behind the ravine and has been soaking his feet. But when I'm not soaking in that grace, and I'm feeling like, you know what, God, I'm killing myself for you. Hey, you owe me. And, you know, you don't owe them much. I don't have much to give. David's got compassion. He's not sentimental. You know, sentimentality is when you hear a patriotic song at a baseball game and you get a tear in your eye. You don't do anything for anybody else, but you feel sentimental. David's got compassion. He walks out, 1 Corinthians 12, the parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. He grasps the heart of the gospel, which is sheer, marvelous, extravagant grace across the board. For those who receive Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord, it's pure gift from A to Z. And David grasped the implications of his passion for God is a passion for people. It is not possible to have a passion for God and not have a passion for people. And we reflect often about David's passion for God and do not reflect very often on his passion for God's people. We separate the two. But those at the Besor stream, for whatever reason, they stayed behind, grieving, whatever, the parts, as Paul says, the parts we think are less honorable, we treat with special honor. That's what David does here. Now go on, number two. The second is very simple. Second little reflection on the stream is this. Embrace your season. Now, embrace your season, whatever season you're in. Now, there's two categories of people in this text, but I think there's a third for us here in New York City. The first category is those who go out, the 400 who go out and risk their lives, and they go in the fight. These are those of us who are out there working actively for God. You're serving. You're using your gifts, your time, your money, your talents. You're out there in battle. And, in Matthew 20, that parable of the vineyard, Jesus, when he calls Christians, he calls workers. When God created you to work, that's why when we're unemployed for a long period of time, it's demotivating because God did not create us to be idle. He created us to work and take dominion on the earth. And when he calls a Christian to himself and makes you one of his own, he does have a work for you to do. He's got something for you to do in his vineyard with your gifts and your talents and your time and your money. He's got a work for you to do. Now, some of us are out there working. Genesis 1:20, that's a very good thing. And some of you are in that season risking your life. That's a season. That's where the 400 are. The second category of people are those who are resting. They're at the stream Besor. And we are in different places at different times. And there is a time to rest. There is a time to not go to battle. And to stay at the stream Besor and take your shoes off and soak your feet for a while. I think New Life, one of our great strengths over the years, has been a place for people to rest and heal and become whole from being battered. But the result of this rest was that these 200, if you read the text, they were ready for the next battle. Now, I remember my own sabbatical. I took a sabbatical for 3 months about 4 or 5 years ago, and I'll never forget how I felt at the end of that sabbatical. I was so rested. I had so much in me, I couldn't help but go to battle. But I did need a rest. We all need rest on small scales, larger scales, along the way. You got to discern, what season am I in? Now, again, we get exhausted from losses, from grieving, from battles, from a variety of reasons, from hurts. But there are seasons, and we've got to embrace it. And when it's time to rest, if you're out there trying to fight, you become a very bitter, angry person. I love where Eugene Peterson talks about a friend would write letters to him and would sign the letter at the end. You know, sincerely yours. Joe Schmo would say, yours at the Besor stream. Judy, because she saw herself as one of the 200 at the Besor stream. She was too tired to go on. She'd made some big mistakes, sins. She was now on the sideline. She'd failed. She was weak. She was tired. She was frightened. She was healing. She was healing, and she was able to articulate, yours at the Besor stream, here I am. Some of you may be there right now, and that's a good thing. But there's a third category, because we live in New York, and I know some of you are in this case too, and that is, you're not in battle, but you're not really resting either. You're just pure stressed out. And so what you've done at the Besor stream is you've built a condominium for yourself. And maybe you've actually created a whole hotel complex and you're receiving visitors too. But you're not in battle. You're not resting. You're just plain stressed out. And you're exhausted from living life. just living life in a place like New York City, friends, and traffic and construction and all that goes on, your life is unfocused and your life does not have direction. You're simply by the stream of Besser year after year after year, and you're never getting up. And that's a great problem. And some of you, again, you know, you're just overwhelmed year after year. So what do you do? Here's my answer. I don't know. I can't get you out of the hotel, all right? I know you got the jacuzzi and everything going on in there. Some of you got room service. I can get carried away. All right, now, how do you get up? How do you move on? Some of you say, I'm overwhelmed by life. It's not fighting for God. It's just life. Well, I think it's found in verse 6. And the only way, how did David get up? He'd been beaten down. He'd just been in battle. He was exhausted. He's got 400, he got 600 guys who want to kill him. He's got another battle to fight. Where did he get the energy to get up and leave? And this text is very clear. It says in verse 6, he strengthened himself in the Lord God. Now, understand that there's a preposition. He strengthened himself in God. Somehow he got to God, and God infused him with power. He strengthened himself in God, and then he got something from God. I believe that. So whatever it means for you to strengthen yourself, and then he got some spiritual counsel from somebody who was walking with God, Abiathar, a priest. Some of you need to connect with cell leaders and other folks. Get some connections with folks who can strengthen you in God. But you know what? If you don't get that strength from God, in him and from him, you will be at the stream of Besor for the rest of your life. And are you resting? You're just basically trying to survive. But God has given you something to do. So listen, for the body to be the body, one does need to give. Now, to go to battle, friends, you don't realize that's how you mature and grow. You were created for that. God, we experience a fulfillment and a joy that's found in no other place. You were made to give as well as to receive. Let me close with a little story. From a Hasidic rabbi to another rabbi, this rabbi was having a conversation with God about heaven and hell. And God says to the rabbi, I'm going to show you hell. And he leads the rabbi to a room containing all of these people sitting around a large circular table. And in the middle of the table is this huge pot of stew that just fills the room with this delicious aroma. And all these people have long spoons. And they're all dipping the spoon into the stew. But all the people are famished. They're thin, they're undernourished, they're angry, and the room is just a horrible place to be. Because their spoons are so long, they reach into the stew, but they can't get the spoon to their mouths because it's such a long spoon. And they're dying of hunger. He says, that's hell. And then he takes the rabbi and he brings him to another room. And in this room is the same circular table, and all these people sitting around a table, and they got long spoons, and they got this delicious pot of stew in the middle, and they got their long spoons, and they're all dipping it in. But in this table, this room is full of joy and singing and laughter, and they're well-fed, and they're fully nourished, and it's a great place to be. And the rabbi says, well, what's going on here? What's the difference? And the Lord says this. It's very simple, but it requires a certain skill. You see, the people in this room, heaven, have learned to feed each other with their spoons. Because they were not simply self-absorbed. The body, the way God's made the universe and made you, is that when you give, you receive. If you only receive and take it one way, you die. And at the stream, David understands the heart of the gospel, which is grace, which moves us to give it to other people. So I don't know what season you are, but I'll close with this verse from Matthew 11:28 from the Message. Are you tired, worn out, and burned out on religion? Come to me and you'll recover your life, and I'll show you how to take a real rest. And then he says, then take my yoke upon you and learn from me. My yoke is easy and my burden is light. Amen.